Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
The latest episode of the Next 5 podcast is out now, and it's all about AI and creativity. I speak to Doug Eck, Senior Research Director at Google DeepMind.
Creativity is part and parcel of humanity.
YouTube creator Danny Vidari.
AI can give us humans new ideas.
And Neil Maiden, Professor of Digital Creativity at City University London.
AI creates a lot of opportunities. I think it's a great leveler.
Listen to the full episode of the Next 5 wherever you get your podcasts. Enjoy.
The FT.
The Queen's speech has laid the foundations for yet more right to buy. We assess how the latest extension of Margaret Thatcher's flagship policy could transform the UK housing market. Plus, as banks enter the digital era, could their future competition come from within Silicon Valley? And following the Hatton Garden heist, should you use a safety deposit box to store your valuables? Welcome to the FT Money Show, one of the FT's most popular podcasts. I'm Claire Barrett, and I'll be giving you all the week's money news in downloadable form with the help of my FT colleagues James Pickford and Barney Thompson, plus a special studio guest, Henry Pryor, the buying agent and independent property commentator. Now, unless you owned a shop selling legal highs, there were no big surprises in the Queen's speech this week, the first under a solely Conservative government for nearly 20 years. But one of the more controversial measures was the housing bill. Since the right to buy was granted to council tenants in 1980, over 2.5 million people have bought their homes at a discount, a right that will now be extended to approximately 1.3 million households who are renting from housing associations, and they could be entitled to up to £104,000 off the market value if they buy their home. At a time when even the RICS is describing the UK's housing crisis as a national emergency, there are fears that extending this policy could further reduce the numbers of affordable homes. Henry, there was tremendous opposition to this policy. Were you for or against, and why?
Well, indeed, there was considerable opposition. It was jolly difficult. It remains very, very difficult to find somebody who is not a paid-up member of the Conservative Party who thinks that one more demand-side assistance will actually make a tangible difference to trying to solve the housing crisis. We saw from all the main political parties at the May the 7th general election solutions put forward, which almost entirely revolved around trying to help people to afford the already sky-high house and rent prices. It's difficult for anybody rationally and dispassionately to see how in practice this extension of right to buy is going to provide more housing, which is what almost everybody in the industry thinks is the problem and that needs to be resolved.
Well, let's look at the finances of the housing bill and whether they add up. The government's promised to fund these discounts by getting local authorities to sell off their most valuable council houses when they become vacant, and they estimate that this could raise £4.5 billion over time. The only problem is they don't know when those homes are going to become vacant, and eventually this will give them the money to build those replacement homes and fund the right to buy. Does it stack up?
Well, again, I perhaps should have paid more attention at school to maths, but from my limited knowledge of arithmetic, I've struggled to make the sums add up. They're talking, as you rightly say, about receipts from the sale of more expensive council-owned property. But the big problem is that once you drill down into the numbers, if you look at what is actually being proposed, it appears to be, particularly if you take into account the fact that we're trying to get these properties bought by people who are already financially challenged, are they going to be able to qualify for a mortgage in the first place? If so, what can they afford? This may well stand out as a laudable one nation type idea, but the practicalities of this revolve essentially around the one-to-one replacement that the Secretary of State for Communities and Local Government and the Housing Minister, Brandon Lewis, are trumpeting. That's the bit that I think the biggest question mark stands out, and history, I'm afraid, is not on the side of the government.
No, and certainly there's been some interesting statistics tweeted this week about how many homes were built to replace the right to buy stock that was sold off under Thatcher's government in the 80s. James, what have you been hearing this week following the Queen's speech?
Well, the complaints from the industry about the plan to extend the right to buy to housing associations is that really that as Henry said, it doesn't address the supply issue. The government is tampering with what most people think is a pretty well-run sector that is already responsible for a large amount of house building. Just in London alone, the top 15 housing associations are responsible for a quarter of the new houses that are built every year, 10,000 homes. And this will essentially denude their asset base and make it harder for them, therefore, to get investment and harder for them to be flexible about where they put people.
So the very policy designed to create more affordable homes is actually, in essence, destroying the prospects of the housing associations by wrecking their financial model.
That's right. So instead of expanding the total number of homes that that they are currently doing under the current situation, they describe it as it's like trying to fill a bathtub with the plug taken out.
Interesting. Well, there was also a separate piece of legislation that came out in the Queen's speech today, which may get some buy-to-let landlords worrying, not in the housing bill, but actually in the immigration bill, you were saying to me earlier, James.
Yes, so landlords are now going to be asked to check on their tenants and make sure that there are no illegal immigrants among them. And so it's an interesting move that essentially extends a form of policing responsibility to landlords.
I mean, how's that going to work in practice, Henry?
Well, I mean, it's a very serious point, because what the Prime Minister in his speech last week has effectively laid out is the framework for licensing for all private landlords, for them and for their agents. Now, letting agents historically have always been something of a maverick in the industry. They're not covered by the 1979 Estate Agents Act, and regulation therefore of letting agents has always been rather too relaxed, some people have felt. But this this is an incredibly heavy-handed way of dealing on the pretext of sorting out part of the immigration issue. Requiring landlords to register centrally is something that's going to put the wind up an awful lot of private landlords and indeed the lettings industry as a whole.
Well, over the last 35 years, Right to Buy, certainly within London, has been a phenomenal investment not just for the original buyers, but subsequent owners, many of which are buy-to-let landlords or property developers who've been doing up the flats. Now, last week, the Evening Standard reported that London's first £1 million ex-council flat had gone on the market in Knightsbridge, a modest-looking two-bed from the outside. The interior pictures tell a rather different story. What's your view on that, Henry?
Well, this is 700 square foot of prime Knightsbridge. Maskells, Knightsbridge estate agents Maskells, are selling this two-bedroom flat. It's above a Stella McCartney shop at Brompton Cross.
Yeah, not just any council flat.
It has some redeeming features, it has to be said. But that being said, it is a frightening example of what can happen. And inevitably, an awful lot of people are going to point to this and the example that it sets. The difficulty and the frustrations that not just housing associations are going to find, but I suspect, and the one thing that frightens me more, is that just at a time when actually institutional investors have been thinking and considering the merits of getting into providing social housing of some description, they're going to be, I'm sure, frightened, put off, desperately concerned about the government stepping in and meddling, as they would see it, perhaps in an otherwise open market.
Well, thank you very much, Henry and James. Still to come on the show, we'll be looking at the mysterious world of safety deposit boxes following the audacious Hatton Garden raid, and who actually uses them and who is still providing them. Before that, this week we dispatched James Pickford to the digital front line of banking as he explored how technology is transforming our relationship with our banks. So, James, why are the banks throwing money at the digital initiative? Are they competing amongst themselves, or are there wider forces at work?
Well, they're certainly competing amongst themselves. The growth in the use of the internet and the use of mobile smartphones and tablets to do banking services, financial services, has been spectacular. And now, you know, 3 out of 4 British adults now use smartphones, and banks are putting through nearly £1 billion of transactions on the internet and mobile every day. So this has been a huge rise, and banks have to address it. But of course, it's not just themselves they're competing with, or other banks. They're competing with a whole series of new entrants, where you have the Apples, the Googles, the Amazons and PayPals and so forth, who, while they don't want to transform themselves into banks, are nonetheless taking a bite out of banking services, the activities that banks would normally do in terms of processing payments and so on. In addition, you've got a new type of lender on the scene in terms of crowdfunders and peer-to-peer lenders who are doing the sorts of lending that banks would have done in the past.
Well, maybe they can do to our banks what Uber has done to the black cab industry. But in terms of how we will experience banking as consumers, from the research you've been doing this week, do you think that we'll still have bank cards in 5 years' time?
Well, this is an area which is under a huge sort of transformation at the moment, as the technology is in place to get rid of bank cards, essentially, and move all of those things onto smartphones. So at the moment, if you say, use the Tube in London, you might place your contactless card onto the Oyster machine. In future, you could just do that with your phone. You could go into a shop and place it against a terminal, and it would do exactly what your plastic card does.
Yeah, certainly in my own life, I have contactless payment and pay for everything from my bus fare to my lunchtime sandwich using my contactless card. It's quite a dangerous way if you're spending to run out of control, because you don't always get a receipt.
But in addition to that, the cards themselves will become customizable. So you can have an upper limit on the amount you can spend on a card, but in future your card, whether it's a real physical card or something that exists on your smartphone, could have all sorts of constraints added to it. So one example I was given was a parent that gives their 14-year-old son a card which doesn't allow it to be used after a certain hour of the night, and it can't be used on gambling websites and adult sites and so forth. So
could only be used to buy ginger beer. Well, I mean, what about bank branches? I mean, are we still going to be going into a branch in 5 years' time? Will there be any left by then? Will we still need them?
Well, as we know, branches have changed almost out of recognition in the last 10 years, and a lot of them have closed, a quarter over the last 20 years. So they will still be under pressure. But one of the things that has come out from technology is that actually there may be a lifeline for banks in video services, one of the ways in which branches may help. Because if you can't afford to send a mortgage consultant out to every week to a remote branch in the middle of nowhere, but you can afford perhaps to have a video screen with a high definition link, and you can keep that branch going. You can keep your mortgage service going by having, often in many cases, more convenient appointments for the people who are living out there. They can make the appointments when they want, and they can see the mortgage consultant much more quickly.
No doubt you'll be able to book the appointment online. I mean, it all sounds great, but on the downside, does it also create new opportunities for fraudsters?
Well, the banks say that actually one of the key things is that as the technology develops, so does biometric technology. And that is the key. If you're going to extend all these services into mobiles and the computers and so forth, you need very, very good security, multi-layered security. And what they're working on at the moment, obviously we already have fingerprint technology. There's finger vein technology, which is apparently better than fingerprint technology.
Blimey.
You have voice prints, so each person has a unique identifier in their voice. And even the pace with which you swipe your mobile phone, the rhythm and the routine by which you tap on the phone is something that is another marker for your identity. So they can link that device with you, and that's the most important thing. But what we have seen, and the figures out on this today, in fact, from the industry body, is that there's been a huge rise in identity fraud. So this is people, fraudsters, making up fictitious identities, getting into the system, putting down an electronic trail so they can get access to savings accounts, to retail cards, to eventually current accounts. And then after 12 to 18 months, they what's called blow out. In other words, they max out all the credit lines and can make anything up to about £25,000.
Gosh, well, good reason to be protected. There's more information on all of the lines in that item in this week's edition of FT Money. Thanks to James Pickford, who is our deputy editor. But before we go into our final item, a reminder that you can read FT Money as part of the Weekend FT, which is widely available on both Saturday and Sunday, priced at £3. Or you can read online, subject to registration, at ft.com/money, and you can subscribe via tablet devices for just £99 a year. The story of the Diamond Wheezers, who audaciously drilled into a Hatton Garden safety deposit vault, stealing the contents of hundreds of boxes over the last May bank holiday, has captured the public's attention. I'm joined in the studio by Barney Thompson, UK news reporter, who's been following this story. Barney, welcome to the show. The story's been all over the news for weeks now, but aside from diamond dealers, who actually uses safety deposit boxes, and what do they put in them?
Well, I suppose the trite but true answer to that is that anybody who regularly handles extremely expensive physical assets. So that obviously there are the jewellers and gold dealers of Hatton Garden and streets leading off it. But there are other key market segments. British Asians are identified as one in particular because they tend to give gifts of gold and jewellery on for weddings and significant birthdays and anniversaries and that kind of thing. So the State Bank of India has been offering a safe deposit box service for some decades now. Then there are just very rich people in general, which is why places like Harrods and Selfridges still have after, and they've been running these for decades now. I think the Selfridges safe deposit vault has been in operation for 80 or 90 years. And then there are a variety of other people who may have several reasons. Lawyers who want to keep sensitive documents, people like you or I, who may just have something that we don't want to go up in smoke if something dreadful happens to our houses.
Or in the case of the character in the Goldfinch novel, a valuable painting that they want to hide from the eyes of the law. I mean, who else is providing these services? I mean, typically, didn't the banks used to offer this?
The banks used to, but the main UK banks decided to get out of the business in around about 2012, 2013. They all suddenly decided at once to do so, and I suppose that was because they decided it was not really a profitable enterprise anymore. It's not really core business. It takes personnel to be on hand all of the time. If you come in and you want to view what you've got in your safe deposit
lock
box, somebody
unlock.
Has to go in there with you. So it wasn't seen as a very efficient thing to do. But there are still people who do it. State Bank of India was one. Metro Bank, the Challenger Bank, that's another one. That says it has 27,000 people who use safe deposit boxes, and that's growing. There seems to be still a demand for that.
Growing so much. I hear they've put up their prices recently.
Indeed. I think they spotted a narrowing of the market, rather, that they could capitalise on after the other banks exited. So they've put up their prices, and they say it's a core part of their business. In fact, they advertise it and say this is absolutely what we do and clients love it. So they provide that service. There are various independent companies that provide the service, and they are also seem to be doing quite well. And then there are places in Hatton Garden, like the location that got targeted by the thieves. And just to add a little bit of mystery to that, I brought in a quote from a book called Diamond Street, The Hidden World of Hatton Gardens by Rachel Lichtenstein, whose family who worked up and down that street for many, many years. And she speaks of a network of hidden spaces, heavily guarded underground vaults filled with wholesale stores of gold and silver, which is the kind of thing that really whets the appetite for the thriller writers.
Well, indeed. And I mean, in the aftermath of the heist, how has it impacted on the market? Has it affected demand for these units, or even the cost of insurance?
Well, the insurance angle is quite interesting. Some of the establishments that offer safe deposit facilities do offer insurance, or at least a limited amount of insurance. But for the most part, it's either up to you to ensure what you stick in a safe deposit box, or you may not bother. You may have decided that since it's already in a box with a code, in a vault, guarded by several people, you may not need insurance. Of course, when something happens like the Hatton Garden heist, that all goes out the window, and insurance companies report a sudden rush of people who think, oh yes, gosh, we'd better insure this. It doesn't really affect the cost of insurance very much, because when all said and done, for the thousands and thousands of safe deposit boxes that are out there, the number of heists that target those kind of places are pretty rare. But they do tend to create a bit of a fuss, because the tabloids love them. They create huge headlines.
Well, not just the tabloids, evidently. Thank you very much to Barney Thompson, the FT's UK news reporter. Now, we'd love to know what you think about the Queen's speech, the digital banking revolution, or about money matters more generally. You can get in touch with us via email. The address is money@ft.com, or you can tweet us at FTMoney. And you can leave comments at the foot of individual articles on our website at ft.com/money. There's just time to tell you what else is in this week's edition. Following record fines for the boss of failed death bonds firm Key Data, we look into further investor disputes at other firms. Sticking with that theme, I visited a death cafe and lived to tell the tale in my Serious Money column this week. And as usual, we've shared tips from our sister publication, The Investors Chronicle, and the latest Directors Deals. The Money Show will be back next week, but for now, it's goodbye from me, James Barney, and our special studio guest, Henry Pryor.
For more downloads, go to ft.com/podcasts.
Support for this podcast and the following message come from Corient. Corient provides wealth management services centered around you. As one of the largest integrated fee-only registered investment advisors in the U.S., Corient has experienced teams who can craft custom solutions designed to help you reach your financial goals, no matter how complex. Real wealth requires real solutions. Connect with a wealth advisor today at Corient.com. That's Corient.com.
Did you know the Capital Ideas podcast now has a new monthly edition hosted by Capital Group CEO Mike Gitlin? Through the words and experiences of investment professionals, you'll discover who was their best mentor, what's a mistake they made that changed their approach, and how do they find their next great idea? Subscribe wherever you get your podcasts. Published by American Funds Distributors, Inc.